Good afternoon and welcome to this meeting of the Conservative Association. My name's Samantha Means, so I'll be co-chairing this meeting with Dr. David Starkey, who has kindly agreed to lead the questions. It is a great pleasure for us to present our guest speaker today. He was born in Kent and was educated at Dulwich College and Clare College, Cambridge. He began his career as an oil analyst and investment advisor and was chairman of the London Oil Analyst Company from 1979 until 1980. In 1983, he became the Member for Parliament for St Albans, and he joined the government in 1987 as the Economic Secretary to the Treasury. In 1990, he joined the Cabinet as the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, and has since been the Secretary of State for Social Security. Please welcome the Right Honourable Peter Lilly MP.
I think there was a moment of request for this.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be back at the London School of Economics. Last time I was greeted by eggs and flour. This time you've been less generous, which is a shame. I always prefer to begin my speeches with a yolk. But I want, if I may, to consider the enormous challenges facing this country in the next century and how we can prepare ourselves for them. We face the immense challenge of the tiger economies in the Pacific Rim and the new technologies. Together, they will influence the jobs, our industry, our society. I believe that we can cope with them and prepare ourselves to cope with them if we make this country the lowest taxed, most enterprising, best educated country in Europe. If we're to do that, we must cope with the problem of welfare. The social security system has become central to politics throughout the developed world. It's become the key issue behind the riots and demonstrations in France. It lies behind the paralysis and confrontation between President and Congress in the United States. It's dominant in Germany and elsewhere. The reason Social Security is at the center of the political stage is that it's so huge. My budget accounts for over 40% of everything that central government spends in this country. £90 billion of taxpayers' money. That's equivalent to more than the entire national income of a country the size of Turkey. It means that just to finance Social Security, on average, every working person in this country has to pay £15 every working day. That's a huge sum, a huge burden. It was set to go on rising if we did nothing about it. That's why when I was appointed Secretary of State for Social Security, I launched a long-term review of Social Security with three objectives in mind. First, to modernize the system so that it was coping with the needs of today and tomorrow rather than those of 50 years ago when it was first established. Second, to make sure that huge sum of money, £90 billion, was focused on areas of greatest need. And third, to make sure that the total didn't outstrip the nation's ability to pay. Now, reforming Social Security of necessity would mean taking difficult decisions in sensitive areas, and it would be important, if we were to do that, to carry people with us and carry through the reforms, which is what I've striven to do, and I have to say we have succeeded in doing in this country in a way that others, particularly in France, have not been able to do. I therefore called for an informed public debate so that people considered the issues and realised why those changes were necessary. And I'm happy to say that debate has gone in the way we wanted, and we have largely won the debate. 3 years ago, the consensus among those who did devote any thought in the intelligentsia to Social Security was that nothing much need doing, just spend a few billion pounds more. Now everybody accepts that we do need to reform, and we do need to get the system under control. Even the opposition pay lip service to the need to reform and control welfare spending. To ensure that it was an informed public debate, I published an analysis and projection of Social Security spending over the period up to the end of the century. And that showed some remarkable things. It showed, first of all, that far from having cut back on welfare spending, we've actually increased it by three quarters in real terms. And that growth hasn't come primarily from any growth in unemployment. Indeed, as you know, unemployment is falling. It's come from three areas. The growth, and is expected to continue coming from three areas up to the end of the century. The first of those is the growth of spending on invalidity and related benefits. The number of people claiming invalidity benefit has actually doubled over the last decade at a time when people of working age have been improving in health. And it's obvious that there have been increasing ease of getting onto this benefit, people staying longer on it, and people being on it, often helped by employers who gave people voluntary redundancy, helped them get onto this benefit even though they'd never been sick for a day of their working lives. So we've replaced invalidity benefit by incapacity benefit with an objective medical test. If people are medically unable to work, then we want them to get the extra help, and they will get the extra help that they need and are entitled to. But if they're fit enough to work, they should be helped into work through the new back-to-work benefits and the Job Seekers Allowance, which is coming in this autumn. We spend on the old invalidity benefit, we spent more than we spend on the entire further and higher education system of this country. And it must be right to make sure that we get our priorities right, put more money into education, and not allow it to be wasted where it isn't really needed. The second area of growth is housing benefits. The amount we spend on housing benefit has doubled since we introduced housing benefit in 1988, replacing the old supplementary benefit system. That's partly for deliberate reasons that we've moved from subsidizing bricks and mortar, which is an indiscriminate way of helping people, regardless of the actual needs of people living in subsidized housing, to housing benefit, which targets the help on those in need. But there's been one thing wrong with that benefit, and that is that it pays 100% of the rent of those who are on housing benefit who've got low incomes or on income support. As a result, people in receipt of housing benefit had no incentive to choose to occupy the less expensive of two available properties, nor to negotiate a better rent with their landlord. As a result, we've introduced this month a new system whereby anyone choosing to occupy a property with a rent above the average for that type of property in that area will in future have to pay part of the extra rent themselves. That gives people an incentive to occupy properties of average or below average rent, or to negotiate a better rental deal with their landlord, in the same way as everybody meeting the costs from their own pocket normally has to do. Now, the third area of growth, which together with those two accounts for almost all the expected growth up to the end of the century, is benefits on for lone parents and their families.
Oh, you're a liar.
But I don't know anyone that would deny the fact I've just uttered. The third area of growth is benefits going on lone parents and their families. There are 1.5 million lone parents in this country. 1 million of them dependent on income support. Over 3 out of 4 receive no regular maintenance from the absent parent. Our strategy, therefore, is threefold. First of all, to ensure that more lone parents do receive help from the absent parent, and absent parents who can afford to pay are required to pay for the support of the children they help bring into the world. The second leg of this strategy is to encourage and enable lone parents to return to work. The vast majority want to do so. The benefit system in the past discouraged them from doing so. So we've extended family credit, which goes particularly to lone parents, to enable those working part-time to benefit from family credit, those working full-time to get an extra £10 a week, which came in last October, and all of them to be entitled to a childcare disregard to acknowledge the costs they often face of childcare. And thirdly, we are reforming the structure of the benefit system to bring a better balance between the costs of supporting lone parents and those of helping married couples and working couples. We've actually got a position where a working couple with a given income can end up with lower money when the help from the state is added in than a lone parent with the same basic income, even though there's one fewer adult mouth to feed in the lone parent household. That can't be right, and we're shifting the balance. Because we already spend something like £10 billion on supporting lone parents, which means that every working couple, indeed every working parent, and that includes working lone parents, is having to pay on average £1,500 in extra taxes to support other people's children, as well as having to support their own. So it must be reasonable to shift the balance in the way I've suggested. Now, the changes I've mentioned affect the main areas of growth up to the end of the century. When we move into the next century, the biggest area of growth affecting welfare is the increasing number of retired people. We're actually in a better position to cope with that in this country than most other advanced countries. Almost every country in Western Europe relies primarily on the tax system to finance its pensions. As a result, as they have a rising number of elderly people, and their populations are aging much more rapidly than ours, supported by a declining number of working people, they are going to be imposing an increasingly crippling burden of tax on their economy and on those in work. By contrast, in this country, and I should have mentioned, of course, in the continental countries where they do rely on tax, they use this year's tax revenues to pay for this year's pensions. Nothing is actually set aside or saved for the future. It's a pay-as-you-go system. By contrast, in this country, we've persuaded something like 3/4 of those eligible to opt out of the state earnings-related pension scheme and to make private provision themselves through their occupational or personal pension schemes. And when they do that, their money is genuinely saved. It is invested. It goes into schemes which transmit it to industry, and it pays and finances the assets which industry acquires, which will generate the profits to pay for their pensions in 10, 20, 30 years' time when they retire, without imposing a burden of tax on our economy. We've now reached a situation in this country where we have invested on behalf of future pensioners £600 billion. That's a huge sum. It's not just more than any other country in Europe has invested on behalf of their future pensioners. It's more than all the other countries in the European community together have invested on behalf of their future pensioners. So we are better placed, we have made better provision for the future than any other country, and we're determined to build on that success. That's why I introduced the Pensions Act, which is now being brought into force, which is to restore confidence in occupational pension schemes, after that confidence was damaged by the depredations of Robert Maxwell, that well-known Labour MP, indeed the only socialist I know who's ever taken a serious interest in private pensions. Well, we have now established a system of regulation which I believe will give people confidence that that will not happen again. And we're also ensuring through the Securities Investment Board that those who suffer from mis-selling will get redress and no one will lose as a result of that. I therefore believe we can build further on our strength in the pensions field to ensure that in future everybody has a decent pension provision rising with a stronger economy as the years go by. And that in turn strengthens the economy through the flow of funds and investment into the economy. It is a virtuous circle instead of a vicious one of rising taxation. In the long run, the best counterpart to a good social security system is a vibrant free enterprise economy generating the wealth to enable us to provide the services we want to provide for those who need them, but also providing opportunities for people to work so that they don't need to rely on the dole, and opportunities to save so that they can support themselves rather than relying on the taxpayer. I believe this country is now in a better position to have that vibrant free enterprise economy and maintain sustained non-inflationary growth for the foreseeable future. Because we've succeeded in getting our inflation down to the lowest level for a generation, we've got interest rates down to the lowest level for 30 years, we've got unemployment down to the lowest level of any major country in Western Europe, and falling where it's rising in France and Germany, And we've got a higher proportion of our people in work than any major country in Europe. So we are succeeding, and if we continue on the lines that I've suggested, we will continue to succeed. The only threat is that we should deviate from those paths and go back to the policies which have brought us problems in the past and mean that many other countries still face the sort of insurmountable problems that they at present seem unable to tackle in their welfare and other spheres. We have to remember that every reform that I've introduced has been opposed by the Labour Party, even though the Labour Party paid lip service to the need for reform. If their votes had won the day, they would be compelled to spend out an extra £5 billion a year at the end of this century, rising to an extra £15 billion a year in the next century. As it is, as a result of our reforms, we've succeeded in reducing the rate of growth of Social Security to an affordable level. Social Security system, since it was set up in the late 40s as a result of the Beveridge reforms, has grown by 5% a year in real terms. It's about twice as rapidly as the economy, and it's been the principal engine of rising taxes and costs. We have now, as a result of our reforms, reduced the likely rate of growth to a little over 1%, half the rate of growth of the economy, and that means that we can look forward to declining taxes while still seeing improving provision for those in need. I believe that that's a record to be proud of, and one that we should reinforce and continue. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're now moving to what I think for most people will be the highlight of the event, which are the questions. The last time I actually chaired Peter Lilly was one of the stages of that great debate to which he referred. It was a meeting of the Bow Group, which is a sort of curious, sort of slushy center of conservatism, and Peter was sitting on my left hand, and the leading Labour MP and rethinker of the social security from the point of view of the Labour Party was on my right hand. And my general feeling was that in ordinary politics, what Peter said was distinctly to the left of what Frank was saying. And so the debate... What I like about these people is their general sense of discrimination in their particular, in their political judgments. Bastards all. And of course... And I'm allowed to say, it, of course, because the Prime Minister, as it were, legitimated the term in political debate. Now, what we're going to do now is actually, as I said, have the questions. The other reason why this should be a very good session, and again the Secretary of State referred to it, in a sense, social welfare was invented here in Houghton Street. Beveridge was, of course, the director of the school. He was a liberal, as indeed most of the people who thought about this sensibly were, rather than members of either the right, the extremer right, or the extremer left. The school has also got a distinguished tradition in terms of departments specifically devoted to this, which again, from a very wide-ranging perspective, have questioned the nature, the dimensions, and the costs of welfare. Would it be too much to hope that we can actually, rather than sending the Secretary of State away with a stain on his suit, send him away with something to think about? When you ask your question, would you please stand? This is not so that I can write your name down and proceed against you, but it's so that you can have a radio mic which will enable everybody to hear what you've got to say. I'll indicate for the stewards who is going to ask the question, and then the microphone can be delivered to them. So the first question, please. And can the questions be brief, and then we can get a lot in, right? Down there, please.
In October 1993, you made a speech to the Conservative Party conference in which, excuse me, but I'm actually of European origin. In other countries they're called congresses. That aside, you made a speech to the party conference in which you insinuated that Europeans, French, Italians and Germans were coming to Britain to take away British benefits. And if I remember rightly, on Italians you said something like, mio bambino in Italia, send my child benefit to Italy. Now, as someone of partly Italian origin, I found this very offensive. Can you really justify statements such as this and the policy that's now being directed particularly to refugees, which I think are clearly being tailored for a racist or pseudo-racist? Can you justify them morally? Because the church the churches have condemned this kind of
policy.
You're
giving us a speech. Can we have the question and then the Secretary of State can reply?
The church has condemned it as unchristian and brutal.
Could we have the question? No, can we have the question and then we can have a reply? Thank you.
The question is, can you justify these policies and these statements morally?
Yes, indeed.
I think that was a non-racist remark, was it? Good. Now,
there were two issues: that of the habitual residence test and that of the asylum seekers changes. The system we had before meant that it was possible for people from within the European community, indeed the European Economic Area, to come to this country and claim benefits and exercise what became known as benefit tourism, pretending to be looking for work and actually claiming income support and housing benefit. When I made that speech, the immediate response of the bien-pensant liberals was to say, this is absolute nonsense, doesn't happen, and Time Out, that well-known right-wing magazine, went round the streets of London and through the language courses and so on to find evidence that what I was saying was complete rubbish. Instead, they published a lot of interviews with people from the continent saying, yes, that's precisely what they were doing. They thought it was quite daft of the British people to allow it to happen, and couldn't understand why we did. I therefore changed it and put us on the same basis as Italy, France, Spain, and Germany. Treat people from this country who go there very sensibly, in my view. They don't allow them to claim benefits when they're essentially on holiday. Now then we come to the question of asylum seekers, which the gentleman over there asked me to address. There we have a position where last year 57,000 people came to this country seeking asylum.
How many left?
Only 2,500 were actually removed and deported, as it so happened. Shall I deal with one problem at a time? The problem of asylum seekers is worldwide, but in the rest of Europe, the numbers have been coming down. The last year for which we have figures available, they fell by about 45% in the rest of Europe and rose by a similar amount in this country, because the other countries of Europe have been tightening up on their controls and benefit system, and ours has remained one of the most attractive. But that's why people come here. Clearly 57,000 people don't believe that. That's why they've come here. Now, as it so happens, when they have had their claims investigated, over 90% are found not to be genuine refugees under the definition laid down in international agreements since 1951 in the Geneva Convention. What we're saying is that anyone who comes to this country, and when they come says, and they're asked at the port of entry, why are you here? They say, I'm here to seek asylum. They will be allowed to have benefits while they're pursuing their claim, and the claim is being considered by the Home Office. Now, if, however, they tell the immigration officials that they are coming here as students, as businessmen, as tourists, and convince the officials that they have the means to support themselves, as they're required to do, that they probably got a means to return to their home country, or a ticket to do so, that they have got somewhere to stay, and that they are genuine in those things. After they've done that difficult task of convincing, if they subsequently get in this country and learn that by claiming asylum, then they can get entitlement to benefit, having first of all recognized that they weren't entitled to it, then we think that that is foolish and we're no longer going to continue to give benefit to people in those circumstances. Now, after they've been found not to be asylum seekers, as in 90% of the cases they are, more than 90% of the cases they are, at present, they are given benefits if they appeal. No British citizen is given benefits if he appeals against the refusal or removal of benefits, and they do not get benefit during the appeal stage. We're putting asylum seekers on the same basis as British citizens. If you think that's racist, I think the previous situation was discriminating and unequal.
In the middle there, please. Sorry, you've had your say. I'm trying.
Sorry, it was a British sense of humour, but perhaps perhaps that's not universally accepted.
Could I have the next question, please? Be quiet, please.
Yes, he does, most years.
But could we have another question, please? Thanks.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about the government's white paper on housing. And you spoke about the need for British citizens to be not necessarily cared for, but to be met at their point of need. And what I want your comments on, if you would, is about single mothers and people who are in severe need, who will be severely affected by the changes in the proposed white paper on housing.
I don't think they will be severely affected. The existing, or the previous rules under the Homeless Persons Act, gave an obligation on local authorities to provide permanent housing for certain priority groups. Now, including those who are, find themselves homeless, who've got children in particular. Now, it will still be an obligation of local authorities to provide accommodation for those in those priority groups, above all those who are homeless and with children. But they won't have to provide permanent housing. And that's reasonable because very often people find themselves temporarily in need and subsequently that need disappears, either because they get back with their spouse, they get a job and look after themselves. It's not inconceivable even that some of you will eventually get jobs and support yourselves. Many responsible parents who find themselves temporarily homeless do subsequently become self-supporting. And there's no particular reason why they should be given priority over other people in the housing list for permanent housing. But there will still be an obligation to provide them with housing as long as they have that temporary need.
Yeah. There is the three or four rows back. Yeah. Keep your hand up and stand if you would, please. Yeah, you. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, it's very...
I wonder if you could explain why Job Seekers Allowance was put back to October from April. Is it to do with the employment service staff, due to the increased number of tax and employment services, refusing to cooperate with pilot schemes? And I wonder if you could explain, you've said that £15 a day is being paid by working people for the current social security benefits. Are you prepared to see employment service and benefits agency staff paying daily with the fear of safety and fear for their lives for the Job Seekers Allowance?
The reason we postponed from April to October the full implementation of the Job Seekers Allowance is that it is an immensely complicated process bringing together the present income support system and the unemployment benefits system. We have two sets of staff, up to 60,000 people in benefit agency offices, not quite equal number in employment services offices. The amount of exchange between them is the greatest number of pieces of correspondence, both telephonically and in writing, between any two organisations in Europe that we know of. So we're trying to bring them together, cut out all that waste and inefficiency. But in the process, we have to redesign systems. Experience in the past has shown that if you rush precipitately and introduce new complex bureaucratic and computer systems, they don't go well. So we've learned from experience, as the gentleman reminded me we should, and made sure that this time we have time to do it thoroughly and efficiently. It's certainly not employment services staff who are objecting to the new arrangements. They presently work without screens between themselves and their customers, and they want to continue doing so. In some circumstances, my staff have had a screen between themselves and their customers, and it's unfamiliar to go into the employment services environment. In every area where that is being required, we're carrying out a safety assessment to make sure that there is safe provision for our staff, and obviously it is a priority to make sure that my staff are working in conditions which are right and safe for them.
Could I, I can't see at the back there where my finger's pointing down. Yeah, if you'll stand up. Thanks. Could I have a microphone, please?
Thanks. This is a question, but if you'll forgive me, there are some very brief figures that lead up to it. At I think the 93 Tory conference, you were very vocal about the £500 million that was being cost the country because of social security evasion. On the day after the budget in 1993, the FT reported that the Treasury was writing off £900 million in tax evasion, and some estimates reckon that the Treasury loses £6 billion a year on tax evasion. Now, I congratulate you very much because of that £500 million, four-fifths was then recovered, which makes an estimate that tax evasion is costing the country 60 times as much as social security evasion. Now, this is a question. The fact that we never hear about this, I'm going to put it to you that this makes the economic arguments against social security evasion as being responsible for so many ills of our society as a complete nonsense. There is no economic argument. I put it to you that it's an ideological argument because it's politically embarrassing to point the finger at the real people who are causing such financial disaster for the country, which is those firms and the rich people.
I mean, there is a kernel of truth in what you say, in that both tax evasion and fraud and abuse of the social security system are wrong, and we should and do take vigorous action to stop them. I used to be responsible for the Inland Revenue when I was Financial Secretary, and every year we introduced extensive legislation. Alas, I'll try to answer your question before you come back. And every year I introduced extensive legislation to cut down on loopholes, to close loopholes as fast as clever accountants found new ones. We would close them down and stop them. Alas, as Social Security Secretary, I don't have a bill every year to do similar work on fraud, but I introduced some regulations to close loopholes and stop abuse. One notable one, abuse by city firms, for example, of the national insurance system, getting around it by paying their staff in gold bullion or racehorses or whatnot so that they could avoid paying national insurance contributions. I made a big thing in that very speech you refer to about the efforts I was introducing to stop that. The idea that some alternative, you either crack down on fraud or you crack down on tax evasion, is nonsense. You crack down on both. Oh, but your figures, now you remind me. What we have done over the last few months is try to evaluate the actual extent of fraud. And I've carried out a number of surveys, benefit by benefit. So far we've done income support, unemployment benefit, and housing benefit. A detailed investigation of where the money is actually going. And we found that the level in those benefits, which are much more vulnerable than others, is about 10% is fraudulently misused. That's an awful lot of money. It means that those benefits alone, £2.5 billion, is being abused and taken fraudulently, over and above what, of course, we've identified and stopped through the measures you mentioned.
Yeah, certainly, but quickly, thanks.
Thank you. As regards cracking down equally, the point I'm making is not that you shouldn't necessarily crack down on social security evaders. What I'm saying is that we never ever hear about tax evasion, which is why I'm talking about it as an ideological battle. Also, as regards cracking down equally, in 1992, 8,000 people were prosecuted for social security evasion, 14 for tax evasion.
As I say, you did hear from me about my responsibility for preventing abuse of the national insurance system and companies avoiding paying that, which is effectively similar to avoiding paying tax. You didn't hear so much when I was Financial Secretary to the Treasury because I wasn't allowed to make speeches at the party conference.
Could we? Down there, please. Yeah, microphone there, please. Is that microphone working?
Hold it.
Treat it like a lolly, you know. I mean, get it really close, yes. No. I think this is a little problem with technological literacy, right? Okay.
Start again.
Yeah.
Here at the LSE, I'm sure you'd agree, no one deserves to be allowed to study on the basis of ability to pay. And although education is a part of your portfolio, would you not agree that a move such as top-up fees would restrict education at institutions such as the LSE to the middle and upper classes? I certainly would not have been able to come to the LSE to pay to get in, and that the blame rests squarely with your government's policies.
I believe the Secretary of State for Education has made it quite clear that it's not our intention to require such charges. On the contrary, we have been trying to and those charges have been mooted in terms of meeting the capital costs because of the change in the financing arrangements for capital. We're not actually cutting capital budgets. We're trying to transfer from tax finance capital to the private finance initiative to get outside capital into institutions of higher education. And we believe that that can be successfully achieved and that these mootage charges would not be necessary.
Behind you. Sorry. There you are. That's right.
Considering the credit card fraud, the social security fraud, tax evasion that occurs in this country, not to mention the violence in Northern Ireland over the past few years, what strikes me as being quite odd that in this country there is no such... Sorry. There is no such thing as an identity card with a photograph. Now, in the rest of Europe, which are considered as democratic countries as well, they do have one and are used very, very effectively. Now, considering that credit card agencies, credit rating agencies, as well as institutions which may have, government institutions...
Sorry, we're running out of time. Could you come to the question?
May have this information required. I was just wondering, what are the remaining objections against having an identity card with a photograph in this country?
I am intending to introduce a benefit payment card starting in the autumn to replace the present system of paying out social security benefits through the post office via order books. This will be more secure. It will be more secure above all for pensioners and others going to get their money because there'll be no point in stealing this card. It won't be usable by others in the way that the order books can be stolen and used by others. But that's a different thing from a national identity card. We are consulting on identity cards. The Home Secretary has had a consultation, and I think it must be drawing to a close fairly soon. But we've put forward a number of options, essentially, for voluntary cards. We have to take into account there are both positives and negatives in this. Some people imagine it would be a great help with fraud and with crime and so on, though the average criminal doesn't put down on his identity card occupation burglar. And those who are caught on the scene of the crime, it's usually not a problem establishing their identity. The problem is actually catching them on the scene of the crime. What we have to recognize is there are also downsides. In Australia, they had a big debate about this, and I understand initially 90% of people were in favor of establishing a national identity card. It seemed a good idea. No one had anything to fear if they were innocent and so on. Then as they got into introducing it, and the arguments became clearer, and people realized that if it's a compulsory card that you are compelled by law to carry with you, it means it's an offense if you forget to carry it with you. If you forget to notify a change of an address, you're committing offence. If you lose it, fail to notify people that you've lost it and get a new one, go through the hassle of that. In the meantime, when you've lost it, you're at a disadvantage of not being able to fulfil the requirements. There is a lot of hassle involved in a compulsory identity card. And in Australia, it moved from 90% in favour of the idea to 75% against. We have a proud tradition in this country of assuming people are innocent unless they're proven guilty, that we don't require people to prove their innocence or prove who they are in the streets of the country. And that is something we would only give up if we were convinced there were very great benefits on the other side of the scale. I, for one, remember as a youth living in Paris and going out with some of my chums, teenage chums, we were stopped by the military during the OAS crisis, and required to show our identity cards. And they were furious because they hadn't got them with them. They were afraid that they were committing an offence. As an English person, I just thought that we don't have to prove that. And that's actually something that, on the whole, I would prefer to retain in this country and retain that freedom.
Could we just have a single last quick question followed, Secretary of State, by an equally brief reply? So any, right, the microphone there, please.
Secretary of State, grapevines are a wonderful thing. The grapevine at the LSE this afternoon is telling us that the Chancellor of the Exchequer is also in the building, or not too far from here, and that his speech he is giving to a private audience is promoting a rather more left-wing agenda than you yourself have been promoting this afternoon. Would you care to comment on the unity of the Conservative Cabinet towards your own policies, and will you also be prepared to fight your corner in the face of electoral unpopularity that your proposals will create?
I've read the Chancellor's speech. It's an excellent one. I would have been proud to give it myself. He was unable to read mine because, as you gathered, it was given off the cuff. However, I should give a speech tomorrow on reforming the welfare state, and particularly improving the position of the elderly, and that will carry forward the very ideas that the Chancellor is alluding to today. There is no difference. You talked about the unpopularity of our ideas. If our ideas are so unpopular, why is it that the opposition spend all their time saying that they won't do all the things they were previously committed to, they won't undo all the policies that we've introduced, they won't carry through the logic of having voted against all the policies that we introduced, and that they now tend to sustain them? They're trying to sell themselves as being as conservative, if not more conservative, than us. You may or may not believe them, but it does suggest to me that they think our policies are intrinsically popular, and at the next election, we will tell whether for a fifth time that proves to be the case. They've certainly been more satisfactory to the British electorate than socialism at the last four general elections.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've got to thank you. I've got to thank Samantha for having organised this. And above all, I've got to thank Peter Lilly for having... And I've got to thank our hecklers for being so ineffective, so cowardly, so unwitty, so reluctant to rise and ask a sensible question, whilst the rest of us enjoyed a thoroughly splendid debate.